Welcome to our little program called Blind Like Me. Our guest today is a gentleman from the cold state of New York, Jerry Hallaton. Welcome to the show, sir.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thanks, Phil.
And just, you say it's in single digits up there today?
It is in single digits right now. So, and I guess with the wind chill, it's like getting into the minus area. So it is just way cold. Colder than I'm used to.
I guess we should tell folks we're recording on, this is the 30th of January of 2004. Mm-hmm. And whenever you listen to this, you can remember back then the big cold wave that hit the Northeast. Now, you are totally blind?
No, I am. I'm close to that, I would say. I mean, depending on how you look at it. I was sighted until about 21 years old. I was diagnosed with RP.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, I was in school here in New York at a place called Pratt Institute for the School of Art and Design. And there's an architecture school and stuff. I was in school for industrial design. And I thought, not much of it. You know, I thought, won't affect me, really.
Yeah.
As I went through my junior year of school, I just, like, really started, you know, noticing that I'd lost a lot of vision.
Yeah.
And years later, I found out that already at that time, when I was 21 years old, I was legally blind already and didn't even know it. You know, it was pretty extraordinary to find out. And over the years, I've, you know, lost my vision steadily. But, you know, it's a very slow thing. You know, geez, it's been, you know, like almost 20 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, you adapt. You adapt along the way. So now I just, as they say, have enough vision to get myself in trouble.
Now, at this time when you found out, you realized you were legally blind, you were still driving a car?
Not at that time. I had driven a car right up till about when I was 19 years old. And I didn't drive much. I drove very little. I didn't have a car at the time. You know, in New York City, you don't really need a car.
No, you don't.
You could basically get around everywhere with public transportation. So I didn't drive much. I did a couple of times, and I don't think I was ever very good at it. So it actually wasn't a big thing to give up the license.
Yeah, we went to New York City and spent a week, I guess it's been 4 or 5 years ago, and I thought, what a great blind person's town, because New Yorkers don't shop like we do. They're little, small, we call them grocery stores, I don't know what you know, but on every street, and people in New York go by, pick up what they want for supper, take it home, cook it.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas we...
Whereas I know people who are, you know, who live in suburban areas who, like, go shopping once a week or, you know, whatever, you know, once every 10 days, and they, like, really stock up on a lot of things, you know. Whereas here, it's like, you know, you could be coming home from work and just stop, you pop into one shop to get some bread, pop into another shop to get some fresh pasta, you know. It's, you know, everything here is very much on a daily basis.
And you think that's the way things used to be in every town. You'd go to the bakery for bread, and you'd go to the butcher for meat. And in New York, that's the way.
That's the way it still is here.
And when you walk, I remember when you, I was so amazed that when you walk out of the hotel we were staying in, you're immediately in a crowd.
Sure.
It's like you walked into, you walked out of your hotel into a crowded airport. There are people moving around.
It's quite exciting. I mean, some people might think that that's, some people think that that's a little bit too much for them or a little bit overwhelming. And I guess for someone who's visiting New York City, it could come across that way as being just a little bit too much hustle and bustle. But if you grew up in and or around New York City, it's exciting, you know. So
well, and there are always someone there to ask directions or ask something. I mean, and I didn't.
Sure.
They talk about how surly New Yorkers are. I met a couple people that were, but basically folks were nice, and I enjoyed it. I loved it. I thought it was great, you know.
The flip side of that is, you know, there are a lot of people that are willing to help, but of course, as some blind people know, you know, the more people there are willing to help, the more chances are you're going to get distracted, and people are going to come up to you and try to drag you across the street, assuming that you want to cross it and stuff like that. So there is the flip side of that coin, but it is true that people are generally, they really do want to help. I mean, that is very true, and it's funny, my wife and I get into sort of discussions about this, because she thinks it's the greatest thing in the world that New Yorkers are so nice and so willing to help. As soon as they see me with my cane, offering me a seat on the subway or whatever, I can't help but have a slightly different perspective on it, because I take it in the sense that these people are looking at me and they think, oh, poor blind man, he must need to sit down. Hey, my legs are strong, eyes aren't good, but the legs are fine, you know, and like offer it to somebody who really needs to sit down, an elderly person, for example. So I think it's kind of like, they look at me and they think, well, you know, guy's disabled, he needs to sit down.
Yeah.
And she thinks, oh, that's wonderful, people are showing some kind of compassion. They're thinking, well, let me help some way. So I think it is a good thing, you know.
Yeah, we found they say now that the subways are very safe.
Yes, they are. I mean, certainly a lot safer than they were, let's say, in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, New York City was a very different place in the 70s. I mean, I think that it is far cleaner. I think, in general, crime, has gone down and stuff. I mean, New York City, to me, it's a very safe place. You know, you got to take into consideration that we have, you know, a concentration of millions of people in a very relatively small area. So when you have, some kind of crime statistics, you know, you have to take that into account, because, you know, you could, you know, you look at some crime figure like 1,000 people, you know, killed or something like that in violent crimes in the span of a year, something like that. Well, you know, you got to consider that there are like, you know, whatever, there are 12 million people, you know, so you got to take that in perspective.
And that's in the city proper. That's not counting everything.
Yeah, that's in the five boroughs.
Yeah.
You know?
So,
that's a huge area, and that's a huge amount of people. So
anyway, I recommend if you're a blind person and you haven't gone to New York City, do it. It's an experience. It's something I plan to do again, because you can't go every place. But there's certainly, and I was also amazed at the quality of street musicians.
Oh yeah, well, you know, you got some of the best people in the world, you know, flocking to New York, to try to make it in the music business and stuff. And sure enough, a lot of them end up as the British say, busking in the subways or on the streets. And, yeah, you know, you find great musicians in this area.
Yeah, down in the subways or even just a guy kind of there on the corner of the street singing, playing his accordion or playing his guitar. It was just, I was, because I'm a player myself, played music for a living for many years. I'm not a great musician, but I understand music theory pretty well. And then a lot of these guys are, you know, and I guess they obviously they make a living or they subsist doing this, or they wouldn't do it. You know,
sure, exactly.
Which is just the opposite of my town, where there is no place to play. You know, there's
really?
No. I live in the Redneck Bible Belt, and I could play at church if I wanted to, but who wants to do that? You know, they don't serve any alcohol there, so. There's no point in me going, is there? Boy, that ought to take care of half the audience, shouldn't it? Anyway, I assume your wife is a sighted lady.
She is. Her name is Audrey.
Audrey.
Yeah.
Do you folks have children? Or did you?
Nope. No, we met about 5 years ago, and we got married. Not last year, but November of the year before. So, and we're still newlyweds.
Still on your honeymoon, practically.
Yes. Now, although we haven't really taken one yet. That's one of those things we said, well, you know, we got married right before Thanksgiving, so we didn't want to go anywhere during Thanksgiving, and then Christmas was right after that. And so we actually ended up not taking a proper honeymoon yet, but I suspect we might do that very soon.
Now, you, as a normally sighted child, my buzzword right now is sight-dependent. I like that. Sight-dependent child. Being blind, never crossed your mind as a kid, did it?
Never crossed my mind, and I was so... I was so visually oriented growing up. I drew, if I don't say so myself, I was quite talented at drawing. And I would, you know, use pastels and, you know, paints and all kinds of things, and even pencil, charcoal drawings and stuff. I was very into it throughout high school. And as I said, I went to college for industrial designing, which is basically... designing anything but buildings. I mean, that would be architecture already. But industrial design would include products, furniture, automotive, I mean, anything, any product. And I was very much into it, so I went to college for it. And so I was, you know, blindness was never even in my mind, you know. So it was... It was a shock to, I shouldn't say it was so much of a shock. I mean, I guess I was surprised, but I didn't think much of it, even when I was told, you know, gee, you might want to consider a different line of work other than, you know, designing. and, you know, here I am, you know, 20, 21-year-old kid, and I'm thinking, you know, this is not going to affect me that much. So, boy, was I in for a surprise.
And one day you came to the realization, I cannot see to do these drawings anymore. That's beyond my ability now.
It came on fairly quickly, but it was over the span of, you know, a couple of years that I really accepted it. I didn't accept it at first. I thought, I'll get around somehow. I'll get by somehow. And, you know, when doing pencil sketches, when things got harder to see, well, I used a softer pencil, made darker lines and stuff. But anybody who's had any experience in drawing or designing will know that, you know, you don't want to commit to something that quickly. You want to sketch very lightly to sort of work through some ideas rather than, you know, laying down a final track, so to speak, you know.
Yeah.
And I realized in a relatively short amount of time, I suppose, that this just wasn't for me, and I actually stopped. I actually came within 8 credits of finishing my degree, but it was just those last courses that I just could not do. In the design area, and also even in the social, you know, humanities, I mean, you know, all those kind of courses are the electives.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't do the reading. There was just no way that I could do that amount of reading. I couldn't track well, you know, with just across the pages and stuff. And again, I didn't know really at that time that I was legally blind. I would have been entitled to, you know, some services from the state commission had I known, but it wasn't until several years later that I found out that I was legally blind.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You could have gotten some, if you'd admitted you were, had you known, you could have gotten some help to have finished and gotten that degree, and you might want to go back and take those hours and apply them to something else someday.
What I actually ended up doing was, a few years later, I did register with the New York State Commission for the Blind, and as part of my rehabilitation, you know, my counselor and I sort of like were trying to figure out, well, what am I going to do? Look, I don't want to assemble mops or something like that. I mean, that's just, I couldn't find myself doing it. That might be fine for some people, but I just can't do that. I'd go nuts.
Yeah.
And so the idea came up, what about going back to college? And, you know, I was thinking, oh my gosh, you know, that would be great if I could do that. And so 10 years after I had originally gone to college for industrial design, 10 years later now, I find myself going back to college, but this time for a music degree with a concentration in audio recording technology.
All right.
To a school out here in New York called Five Towns College, which has an excellent recording program. And to go for a music degree was great. I was more interested in the audio part of it. But I have to say that it was really quite nice to get the formal music education, being a musician myself, and, you know, taking audio engineering from a musical standpoint is, I think, a very advantageous move, you know, on the part of someone who's interested in audio engineering specifically for music. Because, I mean, after all, if you are recording music, you're dealing with the subject of music. You can communicate with the musicians or with the talent in musical terms. I mean, if you want to do a punch-in somewhere and somebody says to you, well, let's do it when I go to the minor third, you know, you'll know what they're talking about. So that, I think that really is the best way to go for an audio engineer. There's a difference between somebody who knows how to use a screwdriver and a hammer and somebody who could, you know, make a beautiful piece of furniture. Now, that's a whole different thing.
Well, in order to do what you do, and we're going to get into that in just a minute, you have to know a little about music. You have to know, because of punch-ins and the way we record these days. Of course, it wasn't always done like this, but I didn't ask, what age are you, if you don't mind?
I'm 39.
So, at the time you went to college, this was pre-computer, wasn't it?
Computers were, we're dealing with, like, very early Macintosh, very early kind of,
But by the time you went back and took this music/audio course, computers were a big part of our lives.
It's interesting that, like, within 10 years, so much had changed. Moore's Law being what it is, you know, everything doubling now, speed doubling every, now it's down to 12 months. It used to be 18 months.
Are they down to 12 months now, they say?
Down to 12 months, yeah.
That's amazing.
And it's amazing how within the span of 10 years, how much audio became dependent upon computers. You know, it was a different way of thinking, and I had to sort of relearn certain concepts or to look at them in a different way.
Oh, okay, so what you're saying is that you went to school with tape machines.
Well, we still used analog tape, but we also, you know, they really started from, you know, in this program, I mean, it was a year before we touched any piece of gear.
Really?
It was not, I mean, you know, it's a 4-year program,
yeah, okay.
so, um, you know, the first two semesters, I mean, all your courses were dealing with theory and knowing, you know, the ins and outs of the inverse square law or, you know, any kind of formulas that you would sort of need in a given situation. And it was only the second year that we started working with equipment. And that equipment was initially analog tape machines, analog consoles. It was a very, you know, we were editing with razors. We were editing tape, reel-to-reel tape with razors and stuff. And that was, I mean, that's the way it was done still at the time. You know, digital technology was in a fairly it was a fairly new thing. I mean, people were using it in you know, in recording studios, but there were a lot of recording studios that were still totally analog at the time.
I tell you what, let's take a short break and commence and talk about. I want to get more into this course that you took. I think with the interest that blind people have in recording equipment and music, I think this would probably be an interesting thing to a lot of our listeners. So Let's take a short break. Be back with more of our Blind Like Me show in just a second.
Disabilities affected
our
by computer
visit today
use,
is with
visual
Jerry
impairment Harry. Is the most significant. A computer is mostly a display. And if you can't see a display, how do you use a computer? Well, if you have a relatively modest visual impairment, all you may need is screen magnification. You can blow up the size of text, menu bars, icons, and everything else to any necessary size. Software designed just for this purpose can also scroll text horizontally, alter foreground and background colors, and turn the mouse cursor into a moving magnifying glass. If you're blind enough that you really can't see a monitor, you need something called a screen reader, a program that reads aloud on-screen text, menus, icons, and the like. Called talking browsers, text readers, or speech browsers. There's one and only one generic term for the technology, screen reader. Screen readers are sophisticated enough to use multiple voices and limited sound effects to interpret websites. It's quite commonplace to listen to screen reader speech at speeds no human being, not even an auctioneer, can reproduce. One crucial fact to understand about screen readers, though, they're run from the keyboard. The mouse is unusable, but in practice, it's just not used. A mouse requires hand-eye coordination, and a blind person is missing half of that. Another curious fact, some totally blind don't bother installing a monitor at all. Computers can often run headless. On the blind side, I'm Mark Christie.
On the Blind Side, celebrating the contribution of blind people to societal evolution.
Our visit today is with Jerry Hallaton from New York, actually New York City proper, New York State, where it is very cold today.
Yeah.
And Jerry, you lost your eyesight beginning in your college years. I think you said you were about 21 when you began.
Mm-hmm.
Your eyesight began deteriorating over a period of years. It has deteriorated. You are 39 now, so you've dealt with about 18 years of this blindness thing.
Oh, yeah.
And will your eyes continue to deteriorate, or are you about leveled off, you think?
It is such a slow process that it's hard to tell. I mean, you know, I can tell that, you know, my eyesight is certainly worse than it was, let's say, 5 years ago. But how much, you know, it's hard to say.
Who knows?
You know, so I think that just for me, it's been... a very steady decline. So, you know, but the thing is, while I've gotten by all these years, for many years, with, you know, some alternative techniques and stuff, there were some things that I wish I had done a lot sooner. Like, for example, it was only about a year and a half ago that I started learning Braille. And it really opened up a lot of doors for me. I mean, in just in terms of being able to archive the recordings that I've worked on over the years. I mean, I've had stacks and stacks of CDs laying around, and if I wanted to find something, it was just close to impossible. I'd have to start on one pile and then just go through them, pop them into the CD player, take them out. I mean, it was driving me crazy. And at a certain point, when I had inquired about it with the New York State Commission, they kind of said, well, you know, it's really difficult to learn, and, you know, we find that, you know, sighted people who try to learn it once they've lost vision, they tend not to be good readers. They tend to make a lot of mistakes and stuff, and we don't think that's a good idea for you, you know. And I thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, they're the experts, so they must know. But, you know, I really kick myself in the butt because it really isn't difficult to learn. You know, some people are better than others, of course, and it's not like I'm learning it to be able to read novels. That's not why I'm learning it. I just want to be able to jot down a note, you know, be able to identify something. And I started taking courses at the Hadley School, and I found it to be fantastic because I could go at my own pace, and they actually, on their annual report, their most recent annual report, they actually featured me on the cover in New York City in Times Square.
Really?
Yeah, they sent out a photographer from Chicago and stuff, and he came to the studio, and he was taking pictures here, and then he you know, took me into the city, and actually Audrey came along as well. You know, he had some pictures of us together and stuff. And, yeah, so, I mean, my experience with Hadley School has been really great. And, you know, it's one of those things, learning Braille is one of those things that I just wish I did a lot sooner. You know,
well, of course, as everybody that listens to this program knows that I'm not a Braille reader. I never will be a Braille reader. But because I'm not a Braille reader doesn't mean that I don't use Braille, because I do.
Right.
I have a lot of I have a Dymotape label maker, and there is Braille on hundreds of things around my house. Because learning A through Z, how to make letters A through Z, is a one-day project. I mean, it's a very simple thing to do. Now, learning all, I never did do all the contractions, and I don't need them because I'm not going to read a novel in Braille. I agree with you. I'm not going to read the Zane Grey novel or a Spencer novel in Braille. I'm going to have someone read that to me, lazy jerk that I may be. But I do use Braille, and I depend on it. Now I've got a new talking label thing that you... the Voila. I bought one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not real happy with it. It doesn't work real well, but I haven't used it much. I haven't had a chance to use it much. But, yeah, I use Braille all the time, and I see how... I've got the same deal you do. I've got hundreds of CDs everywhere. I've got... But I'm very anal retentive, and I put things in places. But now I'm getting so damn old, I forget where I put things. I know I did that somewhere with God. You know how I did.
Yeah, and now I've started. I've actually begun a large project trying to catalog these things and archive them onto one of my hard drives as well. Because clients come to me asking me, you know, do you have examples of the recordings you've worked on and stuff? And you know, before. You know, a couple of years ago, I would have to sort of locate the CDs, extract audio from them, and then compile a new CD, and then make it, you know, and burn the discs for them. But, you know, it's just so much easier if you have it in one central location. You know, but the first step, of course, was...
Finding everything.
It was finding everything and now labeling it. And so now that I've basically gotten to the point where I've just about labeled... you know, hundreds of CDs, yeah. And now the process has begun where I'm actually extracting the audio and labeling the music on the computer or titling everything instead of being track one, track two, track three.
Yeah.
I'm actually naming the tracks so that I have them at my disposal in case I need them.
Now, this CD that you sent me, is that all one group or is that several?
That's the CD that I sent you is actually my debut solo album.
That is you singing?
That's me. That's me doing the vocals. Those are my tunes.
You wrote the tunes.
Yep. Yeah. And,
well, I mean, I wish I'd known that. I'd play one. It isn't. It's in the other house, or I'd play one on the. I could have played one on the show here.
Oh, look at that.
Well, we'll do that. I didn't realize that was you.
Yep.
I gave it a listen yesterday on my living room stereo, and I did note that is really well mixed.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate that.
I engineered it, and
but I didn't give a great listen to the songs or the artist because I didn't realize it was anybody I knew.
Uh huh. You see that?
I was just listening for mix. How much bass? Did he really put enough bass on this? A vocal too far back, or is this guitar's panned to the right? And that one, I was listening for studio stuff.
Sure.
And I loved your mix. You're very consistent, and you can't hear. Obviously, you used compression, but you sure can't hear it.
Well, that's very good. I appreciate that fact coming from somebody who's who's into music and into the audio part of it. These days, engineers tend to really crunch things. I mean, to the point where they really suck the life out of the.
In your face.
There's no dynamic.
Yeah, that's
whatsoever.
What they want things now. In your face.
And I can appreciate the fact that record companies want something to sound louder. They want it to be in your face. They want to be it's very aggressive, but it really does. It can really suck the life out of music, and I really try to avoid that. Of course, I want there to be some dynamics in the music. I want there, when something is soft, I want it to be soft. When it needs to get louder, I want it to get louder. But of course, it's all about balance. It's all about coming up with the right balance of things so that things don't sound too quiet or too loud. And
Well,
it's a lot of work.
I'm an old school guy. I grew up with tubes, and I grew up. Remember, the first compressor I saw was an old. This thing must have weighed 50 pounds. It was huge. It was a single channel compressor with two terminal strips in and out, and you had two controls. You had one on the left that was, the one on the right was output, the one on the left was input, and the more input you gave it, the less output, the more it would compress.
Right, so it was a fixed threshold.
The harder you pushed it, the more it would,
right.
The more, when you could hear it, could hear it looking for something. When I discovered one of those, because, when you're mixing, you mix without a compressor. And then my compressor is normal through the board. I can just push a button and the finalizer is in the line.
Mm-hmm.
Push the bypass. And, of course, when you hit the bypass and you've got a pretty good mix, it mixes itself from then on.
Yeah. I mean, if you're doing good at the outset with your levels and stuff, putting a little bit of compression on that entire mix is just going to tighten it up a little bit and sort of make it a little bit more consistent.
Well, depending on how much compression you can make it tighten it up a lot.
Sure can.
But you don't want to do that.
Well, it's all a matter of degrees, I suppose.
I'm saying you don't want to do that because that's not you should. You should have a good mix before you, long before you compress. You should have some.
Yeah, you should try to get it as close as you can, and you want to try to make it. You want to try to make it as tight as you can, and set your levels even before before the final stage, of course. But there is a certain point along the way where you might want to kick in a compressor to hear the result, and then make your fine adjustments to a mix. I mean, the really good thing these days is that everything is just so automated, and you can try something, leave it, come back to it, it's not even a matter of coming back to it later that day. Even you could come back to it a week later, a month later, and have it totally recalled exactly the way it was,
yeah.
Which is not the way it was when I first learned. I mean, I was learning on analog console.
Yeah, I wanted to get back in. I got way ahead of myself because I'm passionate about this. But let's get back into that school where they were teaching you to cut tape with a razor blade.
Sure.
That seems archaic nowadays, doesn't it?
I mean, it's just scary to think that there are some kids who are like involved in audio that just have no idea. First of all, they don't have any idea what like a record is. And, you know, when they think of, like, cutting tape, you know, they just it's amazing. It makes me feel like, oh, my gosh, I'm ancient.
Less than 6 months ago, I finally took the splice block off the cabinet here. it had been there forever, and I looked at it, and I thought, you know, this has been here. It's always, because you move things around the splice block, because the splice block is there.
Sure.
And about 6 months ago, I finally took a screwdriver and popped it off. It was glued down, and it had been there in this cabinet for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to have it, you know, got a splice block, I put it up in the Phil Parr Museum. They say that if Phil Parr throws it away, buddy, it's junk. I've got attics full of Radio Shack equalizers and stuff that I'll never ever use again.
Well,
but I can't
get,
you know,
get some velvet rope and charge admission.
Yeah, I put the splice block in the museum. Anyway, were you pretty good at that? Could you cut the?
Oh yeah, I was excellent at editing. I mean, I loved doing that. You know, and it's to me, it's not difficult to do. I don't know. I had a knack for it. I had worked, you know, with analog tape for years before I had actually gone to school for it. I wasn't doing too much editing, frankly. I mean, I've worked in other studios where the engineer would, you know, rock the tape and splice some parts of an album together or something like that, and I'd have a go at it once in a while, and that was fun to me. I really enjoyed editing tape. Actually, even while I was in school, I bought a quarter inch half track machine, an Otari machine that I kept at home so that I could just sort of, you know, do these odd remixes and or just re-edits of songs and stuff like that and interesting loops, and I loved it.
So you were a musician before you began losing your eyesight.
Yes, I'd always been involved. I mean, as long as I could remember, I was always involved in music. I probably started playing guitar when I was like about 5 years old or something. And if ever there was a piano around, I would just, you know, I would just gravitate toward it. I loved playing the piano as well. I started taking guitar lessons when I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. There was an old gentleman in the neighborhood who taught guitar and piano and stuff, and I took a few lessons with him for a while, and then when I was in high school, I started taking piano lessons, and my teacher at the time, you know, he said to me after about, I don't know, 6 months or something, he said, you know, you're not going to be a pianist. You know, he said, you're never going to be like a pianist, really. But you're so talented in general, you know, why don't we work on some music theory and ear training? And he said, because, you know, an all-around knowledge of music is going to be much more valuable to you than just knowing how to play piano. And I said, fine, you know, let's do it. And so for a couple of years, I did, like, ear training and harmony stuff with him, and I think that was the best possible thing I could have done, you know, because I think in the end it paid off. I mean, it helped me in my quest for knowledge in terms of musical knowledge.
Yeah, for what you ended up doing, there's nothing the man could have done that would have been better for you.
It was the best possible
thing. Sure it was, to show you, because like we talked a while ago, you've got to know a little bit about music to do recording work, especially the way we do things now, because everything is done. You know, I always tell people, somebody will call me and want to do an album. I don't have room to do a full 6 or 8 piece group, but I can piece something together, and that's what I do, is, you know, lay the drums and then the bass and then lay the rhythm guitars and keep adding, piecing things together. And I can do, I mean, my board is only 8 out, so I can do, you know, a keyboard and 5 other things, but I don't, you know, everything's pieced together, and you end up, a guy didn't play that just right, so punch me in after the second verse, go.
Right.
2, 3, 4, and you know, that's the way things are done now.
Right. But now, if I'm not mistaken, you have a Mackie console, right?
I have a Mackie console, 32 and 8 outs.
When you say that you have 8 outs, actually you have 8 buses on that console, but you realize that you could actually use the direct output, so you actually have 24 outs.
I could use, actually I've got 32. I mean, I could
32.
Use...
32, it's a 32 frame?
It's a 32 in. I could use the direct outs to go to the, but configured as it is... set up as it is, I'm only using. I'm just using the snakes, and I have. Well, it actually gives you 3 on each mixer, on each submix. It gives you 3 outputs, just paralleled outputs. So I've just got the 1 and 9, 1, 9 and 17. 2,
yes.
You know, that's the way I've got it configured. But yeah, you could use the direct outs. You could, and my God, you could do. You know, whatever you want, you could do all the outs you wanted then.
Sure.
But I don't have it set up like that. So, and I don't have room. Because part of what I do is broadcast work. So,
right.
So I'm sitting at my Mackie console with a mic in front of me now. So, because I use it a lot for some radio stuff for people.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And we do, of course, my throat is killing me. We do the Blind Handyman here also. So I have, my console looks like a forest. I've got 4 or 5 mics standing all around my console. You know, when you start out to build a studio, you build a room 20 by 20 and you think, oh, at last I'm going to have all the room I want. Till you put everything in there and then you realize, Jesus, I could have used 30 by 40.
That's right.
You've been there. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And, you know, the space that I have, I mean, the studio is probably about 700 square feet. But that's including the control room and the live room. I mean, the live room is about 13 by 20, you know, with 9-foot ceilings.
Oh, really?
And it's a respectable live room. I mean, I've done quintets in there. I do, you know, probably about, I don't know, it used to be more, but I used to do about half the stuff I used to do was live jazz recording. These days that's probably down to maybe 20%. But still, I've done actually sextet in that room, and it was fine. I I should tell you that even once I did a choir of little girls, these young girls. I think there was probably about 19 of them, and you know, I mean, they're small, you know, so they fit in there.
Yeah.
But this was July, and I'm telling you, just prepubescent girls generate a heck of a lot of heat when they're, like, all together. So it just got unbearable in that room. So I vowed that I would never do a project like that again.
Now, but a 20 by 13, that's a nice-size live room, except that it has a grand piano in it.
It has a grand piano in there. I have a Yamaha C3, which is a 6'1" piano. Beautiful instrument. I shopped around for a long time, and some colleagues of mine who own recording studios in the New York area, they have this, you know, very same piano in their place. When I saw the price tag, I said, it was really out of my range. And interestingly, you know, a salesperson at the store asked me, well, I mean, is this for your home? Or, I mean, what are you going to use it for primarily? I mean, he just, like, in general, this piano that you're planning to buy, is it for your home? And I said, no, it's for my studio, actually. I have a piano at home. I want one for the recording studio. And he said, oh, you own a recording studio? I said, yeah. And he said, well, wait a second. And he went, talked to his boss, came back, and he dropped the price by $10,000.
Really?
It was originally like $25,000, and he dropped it to like $15,000, which was still a little more than I was looking to pay, but, I mean, it was, you know, at least it was, you know, somehow attainable. And I just said, you know, why are you giving me such a huge discount? And he said, well, you know, you're a business. You're you have clients coming through there all the time. They're going to see this thing. They're going to ask you, well, where did you get that? And you're going to tell them where you got it. And sure enough, I mean, that is true. I mean, people always see this instrument and they just fall in love with it. And they always ask me where I got it and stuff. And so, yeah, I do have the piano. I have a drum, you know, a live drum kit in the studio, and so, you know, but still, like you say, you know, then I have some amplifiers and stuff, so yeah, it's a decent space for the live room, but you know, I say, oh gosh, I wish it was double that size, you know.
Let's I lost track of time. I want to get into Pro Tools and talk about that in just a minute. Be back with more of our Blind Like Me show and Jerry Hamilton in just a sec.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now with this week's Blindsight, here's Don Shaw.
You know, I was recently surfing the internet and found an interesting site. It's called Assistive Media, and it's a archive of newspapers / magazine articles pertaining to about any subject, it seems like. I don't know exactly how a story is selected to be read on Assistive Media. I don't know what would qualify one story over the other to be read exactly, because the subject range seems to be real wide. Seems to be from about any type of magazine, anything from Reader's Digest to the Wall Street Journal, to the Atlantic Monthly, and about anything and everything in between. You need a real player, a later version of the real player, either the real one or Real Player 8 would work, in order to stream these files to your computer. But if you have a little time to kill and want some stories read to you, seems like they have real good readers for the most part. Find an article that sounds interesting to you and go ahead and click on it and stream it to your computer and listen to it over the Real Player. In order to get there and take a look at it, point your browser to Assistive Media, www.assistivemedia.org. And I need to give them a screen reader rating of a 9. You got some time to kill, go and check them out. Until next time, I'm Don Shaw. Keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
Little segment with Jerry Hamilton from New York City, and we've established the fact that he has a real recording studio. This is actually, there's a lot of us have recording studios. I do, most of you do, doesn't every blind person? But this man is really working. I mean, you actually are in a position to actually bring bands and people in to do albums on almost a daily basis, right?
Yes, sir.
And you actually make money with this. It's not a hobby.
Yes, it is what pays the bills for me. This is a real job.
Yeah, but of course you're in an area where there'd be a lot more. If you know everybody in Lufkin, half of them are going to love you and half of them aren't. So I do an album or two a year.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, there are a lot. There are album projects that I do, of course, but there are a lot of projects where, you know, people need just a few songs recorded for something for demo purposes. So while I do albums, certainly I do work on other kinds of projects, just even editing projects. I work for a couple of dance schools in the area. Now every year when they have their annual shows, you know, they're doing 40, 50 pieces of music, most of which are 4 minutes, 5 minutes long, and they need to get these down to 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
So it's a real huge project to edit these things down and sort of, you know, put them in the order that they want and stuff like that for their shows. So I do work like that, too.
And we were discussing a few minutes ago this audio restoration, or they call it forensics now.
Audio restoration. Sometimes it involves just records and stuff like that. People have 78s or old reel-to-reel tapes from, you know, 30, 40 years ago that they want to restore. And but there's also, like you say, the forensic stuff where I get a 9/11 tape, a 9/11 tape,
yeah,
or something where people are trying to figure out for legal purposes, you know, whether it's surveillance or something, what's that person saying in the background. And sometimes I get into doing work like that. And it's challenging, and it actually breaks up, breaks up the kind of work I do. Sometimes it's music. Well, most of the time it's music, but sometimes it's, you know, it's just these little interesting projects here and there.
Now, you can do a certain amount of this audio restoration with your standard either parametric or graphic equalizer. You can do some of that.
You can do some, yeah.
But they now make lots of, and you're using Pro Tools.
I'm using Pro Tools on a Macintosh.
On a Mac, and so there are many, many plugins that you use to do this that is for that specific purpose, right?
Yes, exactly. There are so many third-party manufacturers of various plugins, and the plugins that I use in this case for like audio restoration are made by a company called Waves, which basically they pioneered plugin technology many years ago, and they have something called the Restoration suite of plugins, or the Restoration Bundle. And that includes like denoise, X-noise, X-click, X-crackle, X-hum. You know, so these are all these plugins that you can apply. And as long as you know how to use the tool effectively, you can really just absolutely transform a recording. Sometimes you could use it even in a musical capacity, just to make something sound quite unusual and quite interesting, but its serious application, of course, would be for restoring old recordings and sort of like I said about if you get surveillance tapes or emergency 911 tapes, you can basically help investigators or help lawyers determine what was being said and what the intentions were and stuff like that.
And once you start doing that, you get a reputation for being able to do it, and folks, you get more work by the dint of the fact that you got some.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I don't advertise. I mean, I used to, and I found that I got maybe a phone call or two a year from my advertising, but I got all kinds of clients by word of mouth.
Yeah.
And I'm still listed in the Yellow Pages, so I mean I still do get a number of phone calls. And sometimes I take on new clients that way. It depends on what they want to do. But I'm lucky enough to be able to sort of pick and choose a little bit. I don't necessarily take on everything that comes my way.
Isn't it nice to be able not to?
Yeah. But sometimes it's out of necessity, though. I mean, sometimes I'm just a project just seems like it's not my cup of tea. But sometimes it's maybe it's a particular genre of music that I feel that, you know, they would be better suited to go to, another studio that is maybe more experienced in a particular type of music. And so I try to keep that in mind. I mean, recording isn't just pressing a button. It's being familiar with a particular genre and.
Yes,
being able to.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm pure, unadulterated country. That's what I do. and I could no more put together a hip-hop album than I could ride a bicycle. Because I don't know anything about it. I know that I like some of it. Some of it I don't. I like the punch. I like the beat because I'm a you know, I'm like everybody else that is they used to call us street pickers. I mean I like the bumping music and some of that music, but I don't know anything about it. But if you want to put together a country album, I'm your man.
Well, you know, there's also the idea that, I mean, bringing something to the table is worth something. I mean, you know, there are a couple of artists out there that are doing sort of a fusion of hip-hop and jazz.
I mean,
you know, so, you know, somebody coming from one world is going to bring something to the table that's interesting. And, you know, suddenly the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
And, I've got Dish Network in my studio, and I keep... that's my touchstone. That's what I, when I'm mixing, that's what I listen to to get my, to regain my perspective. And I keep it on the Jazz Channel, which is 968, I think. And you hear a lot of mixtures of kind of hip-hoppy with jazz. And I love it. It's great.
Really,
if put together right and engineered and mixed right, can really, really sound good with the... with the feel that those singers get, with the passion that they sing with, and the I understand, and that's kind of your bag, isn't it?
Well, you mean trying to bring something new to the table?
Well, no, but you're basically from what I heard on your album, you're sort of a you're not a rocker, you're kind of a more kind of jazzy pop.
I would say so. I mean, I'm a huge jazz fan.
Yeah.
I don't call myself a jazz musician because I record people who are just absolutely brilliant, and they are just monsters, you know, as far as musicianship goes. And so I don't put myself in that category. However, I love jazz so much, and I think that it certainly comes through in my songs. I mean, I the chord progressions and stuff like that are maybe half of what you'd expect and half of what you wouldn't expect, you know. And so, yeah, it's a bit difficult to categorize, I suppose, but it's kind of jazzy pop, maybe a little bit bluesy, but, it is what it is. I leave the labeling to the critics.
Well, so much of, you know, we're not really as hung up on those labels as we. At one time, you had the pop charts and the country charts. Of course, you still do, I suppose. But a lot of stuff is, I mean, so much of country now is, it's not country like I grew up on. I like a lot of it. I like an awful lot of it. And a lot of it is basic country music with jazzed up drums and synthesizers. And I love it. I'm not saying I don't. I love Eddie Arnold, but I've grown to love Garth Brooks also, and all the new guys. But you, what you're doing is sort of the flavor of the stuff that you hear on mainstream, what we would call top 40 stations now.
Right. I mean, it's what I grew up listening to and stuff, and it's what I like. I mean, I love jazz and stuff like that, but, you know, that's not what you hear on the mainstream. I mean, as much as I love jazz, I also love rock and roll, and I just love pop music in general. I mean, I appreciate all kinds of different, styles of music and stuff. And incidentally, I mean, if folks want to sort of check out any examples of my music, I do have a website.
Yeah, let's do that because we got about a minute.
Yeah. They could log on to www.slau.net, and that's S like Sam, L like Lawrence, A-U. That is my stage name. Slau.
S-L-A-U.com? .net. S-L-A-U.net.
Yeah. And, there are examples on there. There's also, I think you could still also hear examples on Amazon.com. You could log on and check it out.
Can you buy there or not?
There's a link on the site. There is a link on the site where you could it'll take you right to that Amazon page, and it is for sale there. That's true.
Well, We've already done this. The first conversation I had with this man, I called him up to encourage him to do Blind Like Me, and we ended up talking an hour and a half. So,
and actually, we talked almost exclusively tech talk. That should be another show just about Pro Tools.
Well, I want to do a show about Pro Tools, but I want to get I want to do like a panel discussion with actually people who are in the business.
Sure.
Who are really making a living, not playing at it like I am. But I intend to put that together, Jerry. I got to go. We could do another hour. I got another one at 10:30. I got to do. Thank you much. And if anybody, do you want to give an email address for anybody?